Hey ho, everyone, and welcome to the Pinhead Pod, the Ramones fan podcast. Remember, this show is available on all major platforms, and if we're not there yet, we soon will be. And the show is all over social media. It is on pretty much all the platforms. Just search for Pinhead Pod. How are you guys? This is your host, Dave. I'm glad you're back for another episode, and hopefully you've enjoyed the first two that we put out there with Monty Melnick and Little Matt. I feel those were great interviews, very insightful, lots of great stories, and this episode is no different. Our guest this time is George Seminara, who directed several music videos for the Ramones, so that is coming up in just a bit. Before we get there, let's cover some news for April. Richie Ramone has recorded the audio version of his autobiography, I Know Better Now. The book will soon be available on April 15th on your favorite audiobook platform. Ricky Rochelle has released a single called I Miss Joey. Ricky is a musician from Long Beach, New York, who performs solo as well as with the Young Rochelles and the New Rochelles. You can find the single on all streaming music platforms, and you can follow Ricky on all social media platforms by looking him up. And thanks to Ricky, you can hear that single today at the end of this episode. So stick around to listen to that. Now, here's some historical dates in Ramones history for April. Of course, April 23rd, 1976, the Ramones' debut album was released. It was released on Sire Records. The album was recorded in 7 days in January of 1976 for $6,400 and was produced by Craig Leon. The album cover featured a photograph by Punk Magazine's Roberta Bailey, which was purchased by the label for $125. Now, this is after the band invested lots more money for another photo shoot, were not happy with the results, so they went and purchased this picture. What an iconic shot it is in music history. The album peaked at 111 on the U.S. Billboard charts, and it spanned two singles, Blitzkrieg Bop and I Wanna Be Your Boyfriend. Joey's brother Mickey Lay provided some uncredited background vocals on the record. All right, April 1st, 1979, the It's Alive live album was released. The album was recorded on December 31st, 1977 at the Rainbow Theater in London, England. It was engineered by Ed Stasium and produced by Stasium and Tommy Ramone. It is critically considered one of the best live rock albums of all time, and it perfectly captures the live Ramones energy from that time. It is personally one of my favorite Ramones releases. If you've not given It's Alive a listen in a while, go check it out and just lose yourself in the music. And of course, April 15th, 2001, Joey Ramone passed away. He was 49 years old and he passed away from lymphoma. He passed away at New York Presbyterian Hospital, reportedly while listening to the song In a Little While by U2. Joey is buried in New Mount Zion Cemetery in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. And to quote a friend of the show, Ricky Rochelle, who we spoke of, yeah, we all miss Joey. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will have this episode's guest, George Seminara. So stick around. If you like the Ramones and punk, and if you're listening to this podcast, I assume you do, then let me tell you about a couple bands you should check out. Go check out Virginia-based Savage Remains for catchy doomsday punk. You can find them on social media and any streaming music service, or go to savageremains.bandcamp.com. Also, go check out Cheap Kiss from Spain for Ramones-influenced punk. You can find them on most streaming services and social media, or go to their link tree, which is cheap_kiss. All right, and welcome back to the Pinhead Pod. At this time, I'm being joined by photographer, illustrator, and filmmaker George Seminara. George, how are you?
I am fantastic.
Good. That's what I want to hear. I'm good.
You're good.
Yeah, let's talk. Yeah, see, you grew up in a military family.
I did.
And have lived all over the world.
All over.
All over. Do you feel like being exposed to so many different places helped cultivate your love for music, movies, and photography?
Well, yes and no. I was always surrounded by people who were encouraging my artwork. Not my parents, but friends of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was an actress for part of my childhood. And she cultivated a bunch of, fellows who liked to hang around with actresses. And they were very indulgent of exposing me to all kinds of art and things like that. And like they would encourage me to do things like, oh, you love, Spider-Man comics. You should call their offices and see if you can meet one of them. And so I jacked around for a while and I didn't do it. And as my parents were divorcing, I called Marvel to see if I could come up and just look around. And the switchboard put me through to Stan Lee. And I told him what was going on in my life and that, I love the comics and I would really like to go and visit their offices just to see how comics get made. And he invited us to go. And my mother and I went up there, and Stan was a like an incorrigible flirt. And he hit on my mom the entire time and took us to lunch. And gave me a stack, probably in today's money, that stack alone would have been about $50,000 worth of comic books. Like Spider-Man 6, like through the current issue, Avengers 1 through 30, FF like 10 up. I just had this huge like collection now of Marvel. We had a stop in a store on Madison Avenue to get a shopping bag because I kept dropping some. And it was lovely. And I gone up there. I had a job in high school working there, but my skills were not up to snuff, even though I went to a famous art school that was famous for feeding artists into the Marvel and DC machine in New York, with the doing pay stubs, mechanicals, photostats, and I worked in the coloring department for a while, and eventually the legendary Marie Severin kind of suggested that maybe I should always wear a smock, and maybe coloring was not where I needed to be. In those days, you mixed it; everything was like Dr. Martin watercolor, they're kind of like dyes, but they're all closely aligned with the printer's inks.
Well, it's weird for, I mean, modern fans, it might be weird for them to grasp. I mean, right? Marvel was not always right, the big movie monster. I mean, at one point in time, it's not like they were this widely accepted. Comics weren't this widely accepted thing. It was
Yeah,
kind
I mean,
of,
it was a little office. The cartoonist Drew Friedman, his dad worked on the floor with Marvel when Marvel was basically, five people. There had to be at least 25 people, but when you figure they were churning out comic books and at that time they were getting ready, they were like touching on the idea of going into magazines. So they did a Spider-Man magazine to try it out. And then, a couple of years later, they went in with the Savage Sword of Conan and science fiction, all kinds of things. And because it had worked so well for EC by just diving into Mad as a comic book.
I mean, I remember being in high school and having to hide the fact that I was a comic book fan because it wasn't the cool, widely accepted thing in high school.
It still isn't.
Well,
I have my wife hated me to have floppies. Just she and I had a lot. I owned a store. My first like comic book store situation was Joe Jusko, the painter, famous comic book painter, and I basically ran a comic store. And we both like developed very good collections of Golden Age and EC comics while we ran that store. We had a safe we kept comic books in, but somehow I ended up with Detective 27 and Superman 1.
There you go.
And the most expensive comic book I ever bought for myself was Captain America number 1 for $90. And when I started living with my wife, the first thing she wanted to do was get rid of the comics. And it was the perfect time because I had no involvement in the comic store business.
Yeah.
I was completely out of regular reading. And so I loaded all my comic books and I brought them to Village Comic Art, which was being written by, I worked for the first comic art gallery. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie, I think it's called the book, The Studio, where Bernie Wrightson, Jeff Jones, Michael Kaluta, and somebody else shared a big loft studio where they all worked together in the same room. And we did a series of art shows there. And to make money's worth, I knew the guy who had created the direct market, a guy named Phil Suling, who eventually had a heart attack chasing a young girl around his store, which was called Forbidden Planet, which was almost the first real chain of comic book stores. But so I sold all the comic books for trade because I knew that I learned how to read English from comic books. I learned how to read French from comic books. They were a big part of most of my life, so I knew that eventually there would be something I had to read. And so I had trade. I had about 60 grand in trade at a comic book store. And then came The Dark Knight. And Batman and The Dark Knight became like a big deal for me. And then they started publishing the Marvel Masterworks and DC Archives, and I realized that I could buy my entire collection if they kept at it long enough. I could buy my entire collection again in hardcover, and it could sit on a shelf, and she couldn't complain. So basically, I read it, everything. I'm always looking for good story, well told, in hardcover. And so I'm looking around right now. I probably have about 6,500 hardcover comic books.
Wow. Yeah, that's kind of how I am too, right? I got read pretty much all my single issues for hardcovers and different trades and different things like that. It works a little better for space.
Lot better for space.
Yeah.
But I do keep two box long boxes in the house, and I have a summer house, like an upstate state house that I rent, on weekends because it's way too big and too expensive to maintain it. So I have to rent it out 2, 3 weekends a month. It's right near a ski resort, and I have two long boxes there. And basically, anytime there's a garage sale or something, I always look around, see if there's some comics. And even though eBay and the price guide has kind of ruined, the luck, you still every once in a while find a cardboard box with a bunch of, worthless 70s Marvels. And then there's like, Spider-Man 35 or time he got the sick, he became an actual spider. He had eight limbs, and just silly stuff. But I always buy them because I had a flood in the house and it was catastrophic. I lost all my photographs from the 1970s in this thing. As I was selling, the license to sell my prints through Wolfgang's vault, I lost like everything. And I just sat there, and the insurance company said, we can only replace you for the prints that you had, but for the negatives, we can only our rule is we only reimburse the cost of the film, not what was on film. And I was like, oh, fuck. She says, but these mulched comic books, you can give me a list and we will reimburse you for the mint price. So they're basically reader's copies, and the insurance company reimbursed me for the comic books that were destroyed. Now, it didn't make up for the pictures.
Yeah.
But it was $80,000 for a single long box.
Yeah.
So I always have one just in case.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, right, that your parents were divorced. And
Oh, yeah.
I saw an interview that you said that books and television helped you pass the time, keep you occupied, right? That lots of times your parents would
Not
put
so
you in
much
front of the TV.
not so much TV, but movies. Because in those
Right,
days,
yeah,
it was a
okay.
double feature for a dollar.
Yeah.
So, and I grew up like a lot of guys my age with unsafe views of the Three Stooges, Abbott and Costello, the Little Rascals,
Yeah.
Fleischer, Popeye cartoons. It was that kind of what was on TV when you didn't go out or when you came home from school. So I had a love of these things, and it was able to find a bit of a community.
Yeah.
But the divorce was brutal amongst other things. And I just happened to kind of stumble into the whole punk thing.
Yeah.
We my parents were my mother and stepfather were substance users of varying types at varying times, but alcohol was a nice common thing. And what people always you hear about a lot about Max's Kansas City. I don't know where you're from, but
Yeah,
if you ever
right.
had a shot at going to Max's Kansas City, Max's Kansas City was a restaurant bar,
Yeah.
and then upstairs there was a club. Right?
Yeah. In New
So,
York, right?
New York.
Yeah.
And dinner, they didn't really serve food, but they had a steam table with chili and rice, and chickpeas were on all the tables. Because they, you're drinking, you kind of get the nibblies, oh, a little. But the harder you were a drinker, the less accurate you were on any meals. So they provided this chili. And everyone, literally everyone you ask, Debbie Harry, Bob Grun, the chili was horrible. But for me at 11 years old, it was like ambrosia. Also, it was the only food I was going to get that day.
Yeah.
And so one day I'm in there and I'm going to the steam table. My parents are drinking and arguing with probably their drug dealer. And this tall guy walks in to Max's. And it looks like he's wearing a jumpsuit, like an all-in-one piece overall
Yeah.
type of situation. It was purplish. And he had a boa, one of those feather boas wrapped around his waist. And he had a denim jacket over that. He was so strange looking to my little mind. So I watched him come in, and he was really, really nervous, you could tell. And he was standing at the closest part of the bar to the door. And so I ate my chili, and I decided to get seconds. And the seconds was mostly so I could get another look at this guy. I had a book about circus freaks, and there were a couple of guys in there that looked like him.
Yeah.
Not to be insulting,
Yeah.
because he became one of my best friends for the rest of my life. And so I hear this. I go, "Hey, kid, how you doing?" And I'm like, okay." He goes, "What's up? How's that chili?" And so I brought my chili over and I put it on the bar and we start talking. Yeah, I said, "I'm supposed to do my homework at the table here, but I'm not doing it." "But you should do your homework, you don't want to drop out." I was like, "No, I don't want to drop out." And he says, "So what do you listen to?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm still mad at the Beatles for breaking up. I don't listen to them. I don't listen to anybody else, any of their records. I listen to What's in the House, so I listen to a lot of Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane
Yeah.
and a lot of jazz stuff, because that's my my that was what my stepfather liked. And I had gotten into some fusion, so I listened to some of the three Jeff Beck fusion records, Wired, Blow by
Yeah.
Blow. And they were, they were pretty rocking records. And he goes, eh. And he goes, yeah, I don't really like that, you ever listen to The Suite? And I heard, because they had broken the pop charts in America. So I was familiar with with Love Is Like Oxygen and Ballroom Blitz and a bunch of those songs. And well, you listen to David Bowie? And I was like, yeah, a little bit. He goes, how about the Kinks? And I was like, no, I don't really listen to the Kinks. And so on a napkin, he gave me a couple recommendations to listen to the Kinks. And I don't know if it was because Joey gave me the recommendations or, they're the Kinks. They're fucking genius. But I don't know if my young mind grasped that. And luckily, we used to have all these used record stores in the East Village. And so, I picked it up for a dollar, the first Kinks record. And, You Really Got Me and All Day and All the Night. And, those are just like, those are incredible life-changing songs. And I knew Syl Sylvain, knew him. How well does an adult know a child if it's not theirs or one of their friends' children? Right. But I mean, I knew him to say hello, and he always said hello back, and he always asked me questions. And since I was in art school by that point, and so I had a little portfolio case I was dragging around with me, and he always wanted to see the pictures. And, so I spend like an hour and a half talking to Joey, and then some friends come over. I don't know who those, I couldn't identify them today. And I went back to the table with my mother, and my mother says, who's your little friend? And I gotta remember, I'm like 4'2". Joey was like 6'7". So who's my little friend? That was silly. But she always referred to him as my little friend.
Obviously for anybody not following along, right? That's you're speaking of, Jeffrey Hyman, the guy who we would know as
Mine.
Joey Ramone.
Yep.
Yeah, and like you said, your mom referred to him as your little friend, and I've heard you say that. I mean, she referred to him as that pretty much all the way up, right? And
Oh, yeah.
and she actually bought you the first Ramones album.
She did, because I outside of the, the recommended Kinks record and records that my friend were listening to, like, it was a com, like you had your birthday, some of your friends will give you a record, like. So I had like Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was a birthday present. The Sweet record was a birthday record, and Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars was a birthday present that my friends gave. And I listened to it once, but there was something about it I just didn't respond to. The Spiders from Mars was kind of cool, but I felt like there needed to be more to that record. It was like almost a concept record, like it was almost a story, but it wasn't quite a story. And I hadn't been able to get into any rock concerts. Right. I had seen, I was at Woodstock. My summer camp took us for one day to Woodstock and then realized you weren't going to leave because there was no way out. No toilet paper, no water, just whatever we brought in, that's what we had. And when I saw the movie, it was a revelation, because even though you could see some of the kids that I went to summer camp with in the film, in the mud, but you could actually hear all the bands, which I could not do.
Right. We were right. You're referring to the fact, I mean, you're right. You were at Woodstock, but you were a kid, right? So there was like this, whatever you would
Yeah.
call it, summer camp, daycare type deal, right? Where they, all the kids. So it was different for you, right? I mean, you hear all these magical tales of
Yeah.
Woodstock, but it wasn't that for you as a kid.
Oh no, definitely not. And I mean, I got to walk in close, sometimes like I saw Santana, close-ish. There wasn't that big rush to the
Yeah.
stage like you have today
Yeah.
when bands play. It wasn't any of that. But I got to see Santana, and that was pretty good. And Sly and the Family Stone, that
Yeah.
was a band that was played in my house. I had a biracial raising. My stepfather was black, my mother was white, and my stepfather was, let's say, his sense of humor wasn't that great. He put on, a lot of jazz, but he had like disco hits he was fond of, or any black artist he liked. So he listened to a lot of R&B. And music that kind of made you want to dance.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a huge James Brown fan. And he said, George, why you can't dance? I'd say, why? And he'd say, 'cause you're white.
Well, you know.
All right. I don't really think that's why, because
Yeah.
my mother's friends who led me to a career in art, they took me to many Broadway shows. I've seen plenty of white guys that appeared to be able to dance. But
Well,
his recovery for that was, well, that's because they're lighting the loafers. Because I didn't realize until high school what he was talking about.
yeah. Well, you, like you said, your mom bought you that first Ramones album, right? Because your quote unquote little friend was in the band. What did you think of that first album when you heard it?
Well, it set my adrenaline flowing,
Yeah, I mean, it was so different.
and it basically made me want to like run into a wall and knock people over, and it I had she bought a couple of records, and Kiss Alive was one of the records, I think,
Yeah.
and I did not care for Kiss at all. Though they did put on a hell of a live show when I finally got to see them live.
Right.
But I just felt the songs weren't there. But on the Ramones record, because I was fairly well educated in the Great American Songbook through the near constant listening of jazz records. So I kind of understood, at 12, 13 years old, what made up a song. And I realized that the Ramones were making great pop songs, but making it as actually physically difficult to listen to it as they could. They were fast, they were loud. I wasn't really sure if Joey was the best choice for singer for them because I'd never heard a singer that sounded like him. That guitar sound that like an engine,
Yeah.
like an airplane taking off. It was really something, but they were all, well, Dee Dee and Joey and Arturo all lived in the same apartment on Second Street. I lived between Third and Fourth on Second Avenue, so I lived a block and a half from their house, where they were living. So it was pretty common to see my little friend. And Dee Dee was funny, but not particularly friendly all the time, which of course I realized later on why he was so vacillating between, a nice guy and a weird guy.
Yeah.
But they, well, for those who are listening and don't know, because Dee Dee had let's say, a substance abuse problem. And that, it was on and off, mostly on. But anyway, so he invited me to go to CBGB's. Joey did. But he didn't tell me when he was playing. So the first time I went to CBGB's, They gave me a bunch of rules. They said, if anybody wants to sit at the table, get up and stand at the back, you know, the back of the auditorium, because they had like cocktail tables,
Right.
like a French bistro,
Yeah.
made out of wire, you know, like the heart-shaped wire, you know, with a platform seat. And it was, you know, it was a weird spot. And so I would listen to the music and move around. The first band I walked in, you know, I came in to see, I don't know who was before them, but next up was Blondie. And I had, you know, of course, I had seen her around. And the first girl I palled around with in high school, her dad owned the studio, owned the building that helped house the studio that recorded the first album.
Okay.
And so I had gone into the studio with her, and we were sitting in the back of the main studio room, not the music, not where you record, but where you listen, you know, where the board is. And after about, you know, 10 minutes, and they're certain, you know, setting stuff up, and I decided that if I was ever going to get married, I'm going to marry Debbie Harry, because she was absolutely, hands down, the most beautiful woman I've ever been in the same room with. So they threw us out. Chris Stein threw us out. Who are these kids? You know, and the producer was like, well, it's the daughter of the guy who owns the studio, basically, and her friend. Could you guys leave? You know, I don't, you know, he's trying to be nice about it, but he was basically, get the fuck out of here. So we left, and my friend Augusta, she had a million words about Debbie. And, you know, it was like before the internet, you know, before people were reporting on pop music, really. Sure, you had Rolling Stone, but Rolling Stone was like for older music, hippie music, which I was, having cut my long hair, I was pretty much against hippie music. And though secretly I did listen to a fair share of hippie music, because you couldn't escape it, right?
Right, yeah.
And you know, you got high with your friends, they put on like Yes songs, or you know, Thick as a Brick, or you know, like,
Yeah.
or Zeppelin, or you know, things like you couldn't escape at that time.
Yeah.
So I saw Blondie, and and let's just say my 12 or 13 year old self became incredibly aroused and incredibly embarrassed that, you know, that I had a boner. It was something about the music and the motion. And when you see Blondie now, Debbie, they play very fast. They play great, they sound great, but Debbie doesn't do a lot. But in those days, she did a lot. There was a lot of movement. And I think, I'm pretty sure now, she was un she wasn't wearing a brassiere, okay? Let's put it that way. And so I could notice that. And it wasn't something that I really noticed, because the only girls that didn't wear a brassiere are girls that wore a leotard, because that was the style, was girls wearing a leotard with nothing on underneath it. There was this whole dancer thing, where a lot of the girls I knew from school were, you know, taking a lot of dance classes.
Yeah.
So they were prepared to just go to dance class, drop their trousers and put on their little tutu and do class. So that, you know, leotard look became a big, important part of my early fantasy life. I didn't even need to take them off in my imagination. It was fine like it is. Of course, I couldn't figure out where you went from fooling around, you know, some smoochy face with a girl and some touchy, you know, some petting, with a girl in a leotard, I didn't think of how difficult it was to get that thing off if you wanted to. That was later in my life. And so it was amazing. You know, they were amazing. So of course I had to come back and I had to make sure I was there when the Ramones played there. And I got there for the Ramones, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to keep saying amazing, but to see the Ramones on that tiny little stage where Joey for sure must have whacked his head several times. It was so small. And I think that's what was really the basis of that big wide-legged stance.
Right, yeah.
It was just so he could be below the monitors that were hanging from the ceiling. But it was another thing that I never had a conversation with him about. Was like, why do you do that? Spread your legs like that on stage. You know, did you ever hit your head? I never said that. But it was so, you know, like when I made the It's Alive box set, you know, it was, you know, we go back to CBGB's. So we have two sets of clips from CBGB's from the time that I saw them. I didn't see that show where they got into a fight on stage and they all walked off, which is in the box set. But I did see them. They were very pissy amongst each other.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know what, you know, they couldn't agree on a set list, which I was, even I at my young age, I'd seen The Grateful Dead and Big Brother and the Holding Company and Prospect Hall in Tompkins Square Park. And they had a list of the songs they were going to play, but not so the Ramones. So they would bicker a little bit about what song they want to play, or worse, Tommy would just start playing a song. And Johnny would give him the look.
Yeah. What ended up leading to you, you know, getting a camera and eventually starting to shoot pictures for bands?
I just started taking pictures of all the CBGB's acts. Let's say starting around 1975, 74, something like that. But first I had like a plastic, Instamatic.
Yeah.
So there wasn't anything. It was just, you know, I'm an atheist. I know some people might listen to this and be upset, but it was God's intervention that allowed me to have an exposure on these films in this dark club. I have no idea. Right, because a lot of photographers use flashes, and I didn't like the idea of a flash. I felt it would fuck up the musicians.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of times now they have no flash.
Yeah, right.
But eventually I got a better camera. My mother went from acting to being a photographer, and she was always coming up with a camera, and I, I took over. I got like her old Nikon, which was good because I got to meet, Bob Gruen, because I had this, kind of quality F2 Nikon with a decent lens on it. And, I think they all thought of me as like some kid, like some street kid. And if I had stolen the camera, they would have encouraged me to sell it to them. Hold on one second.
Okay.
Robert, I can't talk. What happened? Yep, that's good. Okay. You have Tylenol in the house. Listen to me. You have a fever, all right? Take two Tylenol and eat something. Force the food down and give it about 20 minutes. If you still have a problem, then you're going to call the doctor. You're going to call an ambulance. Yeah, you have an infection. You have a very bad flu. This flu is one of the worst going around. All right? You're not necessarily losing control of your hands. You're suffering from bad circulation in your hands at the moment. And so what you want to do is, flex your hands, take the Tylenol. They are not going to have to amputate. What the hell's wrong with you? Okay, you're sick. So just move your hands around, like pump them in and out. Okay? And have the Tylenol and something to eat, some real food. All right? And I'll talk to you later. Yeah. English well is fine. All right. Bye. Sorry about
That's all right.
I produce and direct documentary films mostly now.
Yeah.
And one of my partners, the guy I won, I made a film on Billy Strayhorn, who was Duke Ellington's sidekick.
Yeah.
A lot of his big songs after 1940, most of his big songs after 1940 were either Billy Strayhorn originals or a collaboration between the two. We won the Peabody and the Emmy and the Writers Guild Nonfiction Award. And I am the repository of all of my partner's questions. Oh, I locked my keys in the car. How do I get the keys out? You want to break into your car, or do you want them to open it from call the manufacturer? They'll send a signal and open your car. No, it's not, it don't, that doesn't happen on my car. I just try it. Oh, thank you. I got the car open. Yeah, I called them and it was open. Okay, great. So anyway, it's a thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, let's go back. You were a photographer, photographing all these bands and stuff.
I
You
was
were.
supposed to be having all these bands that I liked, all these bands that came around, that I saw.
Yeah.
Some bands I didn't get to take a photograph of, though I wanted to, what's the name of that band? Oh, Bondage Up Yours, was their song. So, a British band came. So the song starts off with, "I know what little girls are made of. Up yours," whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, it'll come to me.
Yeah.
But I got a lot of, I shot pictures of the Jam the night CBGB's only allowed, they had the fire marshals there, so they only allowed 100 people in there.
Yeah.
So it was pretty good. And I had a spot on the left side of the stage left, or if you're viewing it on stage right. I was all the way on the left, just next to the big amps. And I took a lot of pictures from there. I could get a good shot of the drummer, and the bass player and the guitar player. And the Ramones, the bass player was always on the left side of the stage. Always. He always was. And I don't understand why they never shook it up a little bit. Even when they do their little crossover, they never stayed on the other side.
Right.
But it could be because they're old fashioned and they always use plugs. They never use radio.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you end up getting some job with some, like a record company and stuff. How did that end up happening?
Oh, okay. So I'm taking pictures of all these bands, and then people started, buying the pictures. But of course, I was an idiot and I was a kid, so they instantaneously took advantage of me. And a lot of the photographers were not willing to explain to me how their job is done. And as I mentioned, my mother had a little substance issue, so she was not capable of answering my questions. Unless it was a very technical question about the camera, and then no matter how fucked up she was, she could tell me about it. And you end up meeting people from record companies.
Yeah.
And one day he said to me, he says, "Wow, yeah, I see you around a lot." He goes, "What do do you have a day job?" I said, "No, I go to high school. I have a morning job, but I don't have a that." He go, "Well, we have a program called High School and College Rep. I think you'd be a good choice. You know all the bands, you know all the clubs. I think you'd be a great choice." So I go up to Black Rock which is what CBS was called in those days. And I go up and I go into a big conference room, and there's like four other guys, kind of like me. And two of them I had seen around, and one guy I never saw before. And that weekend before, as part of my high school, they were doing it was a rock show, and they would do like a high school and talk about the high school. And so the teacher who put it together put me on the thing because I'm a bit of a, you know, I say a lot of crazy shit. And so I got on the radio and I did a lot of crazy shit. So they had me on a lot of that radio. And so evidently the guy who was running the program, he heard the radio and he felt I was a good choice to get this job. So I thought I wasn't getting the job because he barely asked me any questions because he had already heard me answer all the questions online, you know, on the radio, terrestrial radio. And I got the job at Columbia Records. Now, who's on Columbia Records, you might ask? Well, Elvis Costello's on Columbia Records. Bruce Springsteen's on Columbia Records. And I think maybe Patti Smith was on Columbia Records at that time. I know she was eventually on Arista, but I think maybe that first record was on Columbia. You know, and Bob Dylan was on Columbia and Miles Davis was on Columbia. You know, I could, you know, if I could get my hands on some records, I felt like I could, you know, make this work for me and hook my stepfather up with some free records that I'd have to piece out slowly so that at least he would be on my side for having this job, which often required me to go to concerts. And so the job began. I got a case of whatever new record came out. Darkness on the Edge of Town by Bruce Springsteen. I had a case of those records. I had 200 tickets for the Palladium for their Thanksgiving show, which I was meant to give away to my friends and whoever else I could get there because they wanted to have a super sellout show. And if you're a, you know, if you were 15 years old and a big fan of Bruce Springsteen, you were going to go ape shit at this show, which Patti Smith opened. And maybe it was Southside Johnny opened. Patti Smith came next. Then Bruce Springsteen came on. And what was great about that show was that as the audience was leaving after the fifth encore, the curtains opened up. And he did four more songs. You know, I had like the Boston record, the first Boston record, which was huge.
Yeah.
I didn't care for it. But I got, you know, I got a lot of people to see Boston. First at the Palladium, then I got them to see them on at Madison Square Garden. I did Joan Jett at the Palladium as well. You know, it was just fun for me to be able to go. And then as I met other college and high school reps, we started trading up tickets. So I got to see the Police at CB's. I got to see AC/DC at CBGB's.
Oh.
I got to see incredible bands at CBGB's. I don't know if you were ever there.
No.
But let's just say it was probably maybe 25 feet wide and about 100 feet long.
Yeah.
You know, and it had a bar. And very often the people sitting at the bar were what are now referred to as homeless people. In those days, we called them Bowery bums or drunks. And, you know, booze was cheap. But I was not the only underage person to start coming to CBGB's. So Hilly splurged on a rubber stamp. And though I had to pay the dollar, $2, $3 admission, he would put the rubber stamp on my hand. It said, "No booze for yous." But to me, at the time, alcohol tasted nasty.
Yeah.
So I wasn't interested even in the beer, you know. And, you know, it's just great being in there. And there was no such thing as asking the manager for permission to take pictures of the band. You know, I would mention to Joey I was taking the pictures of the band, and he would say, "Yeah, let me see them. You know, let me see them." And that was about it. And sometimes I'd come with the pictures I took the last time, and they would look through it. You know, I made trips to Lemoore in Brooklyn. I went out to New Jersey. It's, I forgot what it's called, something Gardens. And you know, I just come back with you know, I show them the contact sheet with a magnifying glass because Joey had really bad eyesight.
Yeah.
He went like through like a 10-year period where he didn't get his eyes checked, but he was wearing the same pink glasses. But he and I developed a pretty good friendship. And but when they started doing music videos,
Yeah.
it was connected to, like, the first one was connected to Rock and Roll High School,
Yeah.
right? Because that was the Phil Spector record,
Yeah.
which should have been better. It has great songs. They did not fail in what they brought to Phil Spector. It's just that Phil Spector's wall of sound eliminated the life from the record. It's still a good record, you know. It just sounds a little funky, and it's just weak. But I mean, it has, right, two of their best covers, right? Got California Sun and Needles and Pins. As you know, Danny said, "Oh, and it has Baby I Love You." As you know, both Rock and Roll High School and Rock and Roll Radio, which is, you know, is what they play the most of in Rockaway Beach. It's got, you know, it's a great record. You know, and Danny Says is a great song because little did the world know that Danny Says was not going to be much longer, right? Because they were touring so much with the Talking Heads, and the Talking Heads were doing so well that the Talking Heads manager had this ploy that if he could get the Ramones to sign with him, he would be able to sign all the bands that like the Ramones because the Talking Heads were so successful. Eventually, he convinced Johnny Ramone that they would make a lot more money with him as their manager rather than Danny Fields and Linda Stein. But I don't necessarily know if it was true or not, but there was starting to be a real desire for them to make a big record and make a lot of money doing it. Now, for regular Joes, I don't know what you do for a living, but for me, even with, you know, having directed 390 music videos and all kinds of projects, I am, let's just say I'm doing the taxes right now. Let's just say I am well below the poverty line. If my wife didn't have a job, we would be living like bums on the street. But, you know, they were doing all right, you know, and their support system was pretty spectacular. You know, between Monty and Arturo Vega, who did the lighting and gets credit for designing the
Yeah, the presidential seal logo.
right, and there it is, the presidential seal logo. You know, like, you can't copyright that because you didn't own it in the first place. And so, you know, it would have been better if they had their own logo that people were ripping off, but they could sue everybody for it. For a while, they were suing people for it. But you know, I'd see Joey around and we would chat. You know, I'd see Dee Dee around and we would chat. You know, after a while, Johnny would recognize me and he would say hello. Also, we frequented the same spots because he was a huge collector of movie posters and movie stills, and so was I. You know, I had a lot, like, particularly monster movies and things like that. At that time, I was kind of into that. And I'm a voracious reader, and I devour movies. I'm pretty much the only friend I have left that has. I have almost a complete collection of the Criterion Collection. I like 800 of their CDs. There's another reason for that. It's not like I'm spending money like crazy. I made a horror movie called I Was a Teenage Zombie with some friends. And the last chunk of money came from the company that became the Criterion Collection. So they basically own it. So every once in a while, I'll convince one of the people that, since you're not paying me any royalties and it's been on Max, HBO Max for like 4 years, 5 years, you've got to have been paid something for it. So let me take my money in product. So that was also a problem with the early music videos, was that I would often split the fee with the money, half the money, and half in CDs.
Well, I mean, you were doing these videos, right? In 86, right? You did Somebody Put Something in My Drink. So when you started with the band, was it Joey reaching out to you, asking you to come in and do this?
I did a video for a band called Agnostic Front.
Right, okay.
And it's called Anthem. And it premiered on MTV on the Headbangers Ball. And for a lot of people, it was the first time they ever saw hardcore. And I did a hardcore video that was the hardest of hardcores. It was the lead singer of Agnostic Front was going to prison, and they're doing like a concert as like a big benefit to keep his small children and his wife alive during the year or so that he was going to be in prison. And I knew the music, I knew the people, and we just jam-packed. It must have been 350, 400 people in CBGBs. You really couldn't tell where the stage was anymore. And it was in the same video. And I got a call. Hey, oh, this is Joey Ramone. Because we were acquaintances, not friends at that point, Like we would see each other on the street, hello, how are you? But we weren't like, I wasn't hanging out at his apartment or anything or lunch with him. So I hung up the phone on him. Why is Joey Ramone calling me at home? So 5 minutes later, I get a phone call from Seymour Stein, and he's like, hello, George. I'm like, yeah. He goes, I give Joey Ramone your number. You hang up on him. Don't do that. I'll tell him to call you back. I said, okay. Whatever. So Joey says, why don't you come over here and we'll talk about So I said, come over to your apartment? Yeah. Okay. So I walk over to his apartment. He lived on the corner of 9th Street and 3rd Avenue. I lived on 2nd Street. I had a house, believe it or not. Believe it or not, the house cost me $175,000 in 1984, 85. It was either that or they were going to tear it down. So I walk up there. And I go to the doorman. It was a doorman building. They send me up. And there's Joey Ramone in a very typical, pleasant Manhattan apartment. Not a like a old pre-war kind of like, but like a modern apartment. He had a couch, some art, a big stereo cabinet, and CDs and record albums all over every space available. The dining room table, the floor, the radiator, the window ledges. You didn't want to, move anything because records were going to fall on you and on. And he kept his door open, which was another weird thing. Because his neighbor had a cat, and he loved the cat, so the cat would run out of her house, her apartment, which Joey also owned, and the cat would run around into his apartment. And he was shocked to see that I was a guy he already knew. And we started talking about the video, what was it? I Believe in Miracles. And so we created the idea of the rolling text, the different images on the screen behind them. And then I get a call from Johnny Ramone, who demands that I go to Chelsea and meet with him. But he doesn't want me to meet in his apartment. So we meet in a coffee shop. And he says, "Listen here, George, I don't want you doing what Joey wants. We're not hiring you for what Joey wants. We're hiring you for what you want. You do what you want, and that'll be fine. Everything will be fine if it doesn't suck." So I go, "Oh, okay. Okay, I meet with Dee Dee." And Dee Dee was familiar with some of my rap videos, and he had nothing but questions about rap music, all kinds of rap music. And I meet with Marky out in Brooklyn.
"Yeah, George, what are you doing? Yeah, what's going to go on, you know?"
And I tell him kind of what we're going to do. We're going to do, it's going to be a performance-based video, and all these key moments from history that's important to you guys. That's what I'm here for. Find out what key moment in recent history, like from your childhood to today, that means something. And we put together a big list, and I licensed all these photographs, and that's what's playing in the background. And then underneath is a crawl that talks about all these moments that were important to them.
Yeah.
But before we shoot the video, Dee Dee quits.
Yeah.
So we have to hold back. And we're waiting. Then Joey says, "Yeah, we hired a new bass player." I said, "Oh, what's up?" "He's a young guy, you know. He was in the military." I go, "Really?" "Yeah, he's in the army. He went AWOL to audition the band. Right now he's in jail. But when he gets out, you know, we'll have a bass player." Okay. I know that in my dad's day, if you went AWOL, you would get thrown out of the military.
Yeah.
And it could take a couple of years to get out, depending on what you did. But somehow, the dread Gary Kerfers, their manager, was able to put enough pressure on the government to release him. You know, to throw him out of the military.
Yeah. And of course, this is CJ we're talking about. Yeah.
That's CJ.
Yeah.
So he joins the band.
Yeah.
So we're doing this video for I Believe in Miracles.
Yeah.
Not a song they had done live ever.
Yeah.
So we get to the studio, and I'm told by Monty that Johnny hates making music videos. And if I could be done with him as soon as possible.
Yeah, obviously Johnny's not a very patient guy.
Exactly. So I give everyone a big hello. I shake hands. Joey's a hugger, so I would hug Joey because he liked to be hugged and hug other people. You know, so we get ready. I get him set up. I get the camera set up on the dolly. We're going to shoot the scenes of them playing live. And then I have all the scenes to intercut.
Mm-hmm.
I have to wait for CJ to teach Johnny how to play the song. Now, it might sound a little silly, but because they didn't play it live, Johnny didn't bother to learn the song. But it only took him about 5-6 minutes. You know, Johnny never considered himself a guitar player or a musician.
Mm-hmm.
"I'm an entertainer, George. I'm an entertainer." All right, and this is how I entertain. So, you know, when you think about it, if you ever tried to play a song, like a Ramon song, like the guitar on the Ramon song, it's not easy.
Right, yeah.
You want to keep that tempo up, and you want to keep that downstroke only on the down. You know, for 3 minutes, your whole forearm is going to hurt. Your forearm, your elbow is going to get inflamed. It's just going to be, and somehow he managed to do that for I forget how long they were, 20 some odd years playing this way.
Yeah.
But he picked it up in about 5 minutes. I shot everything I needed to do with them and close-ups in 35 minutes. And I told John he was free to go. He pulled me aside and he said, "What are you talking about? I'm free to go." I said, "I'm free to go. I have some other stuff to shoot, but you don't have to be in it. It's better work." So I was like, "Okay, it's gonna work. I'm nothing if not delusionally confident in my abilities." So, got added to MTV, which was great for them. They were excited.
Yeah.
But it was just starting to be the period where getting added to MTV was becoming more difficult, mostly because they were being overwhelmed with the amount of music videos. In the early days, you can make a video for a band that didn't have a record deal, and if it was a cool video, they would air it. If it was just a band playing and you had like a closed circuit television, and you happen to catch them playing on the closed circuit television, they'd air that. They didn't really care. Like anything that was like a promo was that. So we did that video, and that did all right. And then I got a job in England shooting another band. And so I started, working in England shooting music videos, promos, I call them. And so I'd come back and forth. I was married. I had, I owned this house, so I had to constantly be feeding the bills. And then I guess in the end, I did 13 videos for them out of 20, I
Yeah.
guess. And of course, I did not. I don't get the director's credit. Heike Hexick gets the credit, but it was hard not to be on the set and start telling people what to do. I play the cabbie on crack in Cabbies on Crack.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
I wouldn't wear that.
Yep. That was me.
I mean, I love that song because I think it's got Vernon Reid, right, from Living Color doing the
Yeah,
solo.
it's a great track.
Yeah.
And it was a true story. Coming back from Overland, which is a management company, Gary Kerfer's office, I got in a cab with Joey, and there was a time where Jerry Seinfeld had a joke, about a cab driver
Yeah, right.
sitting in the back going, "Wow, this really looks dangerous." And so it really looked dangerous. This guy was more dangerous than the usual New York cab driver. It was fucking frightening. And I kept talking shit about the driver, and Joey kept laughing. And I said, "He's probably on crack." He goes, "Yeah, the cabbie's on crack." I'm like, "Yeah, the cabbie's on crack. Hey, are you on crack?" "No," he said, as he like drove across the sidewalk. And it was just insane. And
So cabbies on crack, that title over there, that we can attribute that to you.
yeah, I'm the cabbie. And I was, that was my contribution to the song, even though Joey wrote a lot of good songs.
Yeah.
But he was a he was constantly hitting stumbling blocks. So he would start calling people, Handsome Dick Manitoba, Joe McGinty, Kevin Patrick, just whomever, what rhymes with pickle, like whatever, so he, I mean, his plan was to write pop songs that last eternity, which was, not the easiest thing to do, right? And to a certain degree, he did.
Sure.
Tommy did write songs that last for an eternity. But, it ain't Cole Porter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got to be that person who listens to that record for eternity. I'm definitely that guy.
Yeah.
I was trying to get to before. I mean, I bought into the whole, having a bad family life, I bought into the whole punk rock DIY thing. That was my, it didn't matter. Like my birth dad was a real square. And all he wanted me to do was behave like a normal guy, go to college, get a good job with a retirement program and health benefits, and have 1.5 babies, buy a house in suburbia. That's what he wanted for me. He wanted me to have a normal life. But you know what? I couldn't do it. And when it came to art, I was going to do the art I was going to do, and I didn't really care what anyone thought of it. When it was a professional gig, of course they can make changes because that's part of it. But for my own personal art or the way I live my life, it's my business. I do what I want.
Yeah, but and like we talked, you mean you did all these music videos, right? Several for the Ramones, and everybody. I mean, I urge everybody to go check out your list because it's a wide. I mean, it's a wide list of people and artists and styles. And but in 2003, you produced the End of the Century, the Story of the Ramones, the documentary on the band. So how did that project come together?
Okay. So, relationship between Johnny and Joey was so bad by the time they did the last show. They had been offered to a lot of money to go back to Argentina and play a series of shows at football stadiums. They probably would have each put away $2 million for this tour. Joey said no. Joey said no was because he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Yeah.
It was getting worse. He was being treated, amongst other things, by massive doses of steroids, which ultimately made his bones brittle. Also made him feel like shit and prevented him from ever sleeping. So I would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, give or take my kid to, to preschool or daycare, and then come back home and be on the phone with Joey for an hour. Now it's like 8 o'clock. Then I shower, get dressed ready for the day, and then my dad would call and I'd talk to him for an hour. Joey was, he was upset about the illness.
Right, yeah.
But he wasn't scared of it because he wasn't really paying attention to it. That was a classic Joey thing. You got this cancer thing. I don't know. Joey, man, what are you doing? We got to do that. You got to change your diet. Let's eat these foods. Let's clean everything up. And he was kind of like, yeah, I'm kind of a vegetarian, And I would go and get him these fruit drinks, with kale in it and
Yeah, like
all that
smoothie
stuff.
things, yeah.
Drink it there, and he would drink it, and he would go out to lunch. Sometimes his mother would come for dinner, take him for dinner. His mom is the person who kept him together. She believed in him right from the start.
Yeah, right.
The doctors told him he would be institutionalized, as a child. They were kind of encouraging her to just put him in an institution.
Right, well, because he had a lot of, he had OCD and all these things that at that time weren't really, there
Yeah,
wasn't a
they
lot
had
of
no idea.
information or knowledge about them.
Right. I mean, I lived on a block on Second Street. There was a graveyard. Joey would like to walk on the side of the graveyard, and he would tap each upright on the wrought iron fence that was at the graveyard. If he felt he missed one,
He'd go back.
he would again.
And of course, I mean, when Joey's a kid, right? No one knew. No one knew what that was.
No one knew
Nope.
it.
They didn't understand.
And they had no clue. And it was a miraculous thing. Joey's mother was a great, great, great woman. And the Ramones, particularly Johnny and Marky, were very angry with Joey about not doing those shows in Argentina.
Yeah, there was that whole deal. I remember that whole deal where they all went on Stern show and everything. And a lot of that stemmed around that, him not doing that tour.
And then Marky went out and said every single thing, every secret thing about Joey. And it was just awful. And so Joey wouldn't do the documentary if Johnny was involved. Well, of course, you can't make a movie without Johnny. And Johnny picked Michael Gramaglia to direct the film. Michael, pitched it to him. And Joey refused to do it. And Joey's deal was, I could, if I came on to direct his side of the story and kind of supervise the whole thing, then he would agree to be in the movie. So that was in November of 2000.
Did Johnny view you as a kind of like a Joey guy? Did Johnny view you as like a Joey guy? Did he ever
Well,
hold it?
at that point, he made me like the Joey guy in his head. Like, he could deal with me, he could talk to me on the phone. But he was distrustful in that I was a, more Joey than Johnny.
Gotcha.
As a special thank you, I tried to reach Johnny. It took like 2 weeks to reach Johnny. Finally, Monty had to call Johnny to call me. So I say, Johnny, just on a lark, I've been buying these storage spaces, and I came up with this really cool collectible. In like 1927 or something, the Yankees went to Japan for, to show baseball games around Japan. I have an autographed ball in the box for the Japanese tour with a Japanese stamp on it and actual autographs by Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, like all the big players from that period of time.
Yeah, and you bring up the Yankees, you're talking Johnny's language there.
So Johnny said, so what do you want me to buy it? And I said, no. And he had me read all the names, and there was one player that wasn't worth anything. So I said, no, Johnny, I'm not really into sports collectibles. I just wanted to give it to you. Well, I don't want it. You can't buy me. I said, I'm not trying to buy you. I'm trying to give it to you. We've worked together for so long now, 20 years now. I'm collecting every single available film performance of the Ramones and keeping it in my air-conditioned basement so that we could use it one day. And I'm working for free. Like I just want to give it to you as a gift because I don't want it and I don't want to have the bother of selling it. Just take it from me and you could sell it if you want. Nope. So at that point, I guess I was ensconced in being a Joey guy, which was sad because I loved the band. I just became friends with Joey. and with Tommy. And my relationship with Mark was hot and cold. And it was difficult. So Joey said he would only do it in November if I did it. So he signed the papers. I'm directing it. I'm directing one side. They're directing the other side. And I have all these interviews. I have Costello. I have Joe Strummer. I have all these interviews that I shot. And in every one of them, I asked about the Ramones. So even though I wasn't there for the Ramones, I was there for their new record or whatever the hell it was going to be. I added the stuff for the Ramones. So I have all these great things about the Ramones, right? I have John Doe and Joe Strummer, Debbie, Thurston Moore. They're all in the movie. And Elvis, and so we get together, we decide we're gonna do everything. But then in December of 2001, Joey's gonna meet me at Veselka for breakfast, and he doesn't show up, and he doesn't answer his phone. So I walk over to his house. He left, but they don't know where he went. I missed him. What happened was he was crossing the street. There was snow and ice. He slipped on the ice, and when he hit the ground, he broke his hip. It shattered like a piece of glass. So they put him in an ambulance. They brought him to the hospital. So I didn't hear from him. I was supposed to drive him to what is it, CNBC, so that he could talk to the money honey. Maria Bartiromo, which he would be so embarrassed about today. He could talk to her about, the song he wrote about her and get her reaction face to face.
Yeah.
But he wasn't there. I couldn't believe he would miss that. So it's now like 5 days I haven't seen him, I haven't heard from him. So I call his mom. I leave a message. Later that night, she and my wife get on the phone, and my wife is upset. She's crying. Evidently, Charlotte, Joey's mom, is crying. And I get the phone finally. Charlotte explains where he is and that Joey's been wanting me to come and visit him in the hospital. So he was at NYU, which is now known as Langone Hospital. He's in the Rusk Institute, which is where they do bone surgeries. And he looks like crap. So they move him to New York Hospital. Somehow in the move, his foot is sticking out, because he was too big for the regular stretchers. So his foot was sticking out, and some guy walked past, caught his foot, and broke his ankle. Because that's how brittle his bones had gotten. So here he has a broken hip and a broken ankle. I bring him in the hospital, so they have him a lot of dope. And we're trying to make this movie. So I take my kid to, preschool on the bicycle, and I ride up to the hospital on my bicycle, and I go up there and I have some books, I have some things. So we're reading Harry Potter. There is a comic book, let me see, about lawyers who deal with the supernatural. It kind of looks like Archie in a way, Wolf and something, right? And the guys are real, there's all these Ramones references on the comic. So I happen to bump into him and I tell him, Joey's really enjoying your comic book in the hospital. Oh, that's great. Oh, like, oh boy, would I like to, meet him. So I try to set up a visit, but it comes down from Charlotte that they really want to limit who comes to visit.
Right.
But they never tell me not to visit him. They only ask me not to visit him on the weekends because that's when family's going to come. Right? And they couldn't stop Arturo from coming. But I think they felt that I was reasonable. So every single day, I'd get there about 9 o'clock in the morning. I'd help the nurse, you know, change his sheets, clean him up, put him back in the bed, you know, and then I'd read to him or talk to him about whatever nonsense was floating around. I'd tell him a lot of jokes. And, you know, like he was having problems eating still, so I was still bringing him up shakes. After a while, he couldn't eat the shakes. Doyle von Wolfgang. And what's his name from the Misfits came up with a big lasagna and plates and some wine, and he tried his best to eat the lasagna. He's like, yeah, this is really good. Yeah, let me just finish this forkful. And he just started getting skinnier and skinnier and weaker and weaker. And I was just watching it every day. I was like trying to do everything I could to keep my guy alive.
Yeah.
You know, he liked my wife. He'd love me to bring my kid over, my baby, over to his house, you know, his apartment. And he loved watching the kid climb on all the records and CDs and knock shit over. He liked that. Evidently, he's not the only child that had that relationship with him. Liv Tyler, as a small child, would also make that journey to Joey's apartment and mess up around the same age.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're cutting the movie. We're, you know, using my footage, a lot of my footage. And then my dad, then Joey dies in April, about a month from his birthday. And we put together that birthday bash in that month, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
We got together the Damn, Blondie. Who else was it? Dan, Blondie, somebody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, other friends' bands. So he had his, you know, the Independents were a band he really cared for, and he tried to get them signed multiple times. And so they played Jesse Malin's first, not D-Generation, but Jesse Malin's solo band, the first one.
Yeah.
They played. And, you know, it was just like Lil Steven was the MC. You know, it was a real New York, even though we had the Damned as the headline of it. But it was Cheap Trick. But it was a real New York vibe show, and everyone turned up. You know. And we filmed it. I filmed it 8 cameras. You can see some of that on the birthday bash. Eventually, I had to share all that material with the guys who are operating the birthday bash now. I used to prepare little film clips so that while they were changing over the bands, have something. But the clubs have gotten really hardcore about when you leave, and they want you out by a certain time. So often my clips would get cut in half. Or, you know, they'd be up for a minute and a half, and that would be it. So we stopped doing that. So Joey dies. We do the show. I interview everybody who's in the show. So I have that footage for the movie. Then my dad dies. 9/11 happens, and I have a heart attack.
Damn.
And as I'm recuperating from a heart attack, I get into this huge fight with my partners on End of the Century.
Okay.
I pack everything up, I take everything of mine out, and I go back home. There's some stuff of mine that's there that gets lost, no one can find it. But I basically blow the fuck out of there. I'm not involved anymore. I don't want anything to do with it. So Michael, my co-director, he starts to get nervous. So he brings in a friend of his to co-direct. And the guy doesn't want to do it, but they manage to agree that he's a co-director. So a year, I'm not talking to anybody. I'm not talking to the Ramones. I'm not talking to anybody. I'm just working on putting together the It's Alive. And then I get a call from Johnny. And he says, George, the movie is horrible. You gotta go back to the movie. I said, I'm not going back to the movie. They did me dirty, and so I'm not going back to the movie. So finally, Johnny prevails. He actually throws me a job because Johnny did that co-produce that tribute to the Ramones.
Oh yeah, the We're a Happy Family, the
Yeah, so I did the commercial because in those days they used to run commercials for record releases. So I do the commercial, and I also interview everybody I can get my hands on about the Ramones, which also ends up in the movie eventually. So now Johnny insists that they bring me back on the movie, but Michael Grimaglia had made a contract where Jim Fields gets director credit, and you can't really have three directors on a film. Because part of the thing is the director has the ability to make choices and to call the shots. And so they asked me if I would come in as a producer. That would be my credit, and I would do the hoodoo that I do so well. And so basically, I come back in and I realized that they had made stupid mistakes, like first-timer mistakes, like rookie mistakes. They licensed footage that I already owned. You follow me? You know about this licensing deal?
No, what do you
Okay, so
mean?
you have a concert. The concert was on BBC, right? So they call up the BBC. They say, okay, I want this footage. BBC says, okay, it's going to cost you $15,000 a minute. So they say, okay, we'll do it. So they look at their budget and they say, okay, we can afford 60 grand, for 6 seconds of this remote or whatever it is. It's like a ridiculous fee, but I already own the footage. It was at the Christmas, the New Year's concert. I owned it. I had it. It was in my basement. So, but he signed a contract. They did all these stupid things when I was not involved with the project. So I came back to fix it. And they felt bad that I wasn't getting a director's credit. So basically they said, whatever money you save us, we'll give it to you. Because we're already budgeted out for the money that we spent. If you can get that money back, then it'll be your money, but you won't get a director's grant. Like, dude, 80% of the movie is interviews that I shot. Like, I want that credit too. I still don't believe they put that credit in. But be that as it may. Like 25% of the videos, the interviews, were shot in my house. I mean, a lot of music videos were shot in my house as well.
Yeah.
But they, so anyway, that's how we completed the movie. Was I just told everybody we had licensed footage from, if I already owned the footage, they had a copy from it. I told them to blow it out their ass. We weren't putting it in the movie. It was too freaking expensive. And I don't want to talk about it anymore. And so pretty much we renegotiated with everybody. And, you know, I might be the only person who made any money on the film.
Oh, man.
But it was, you know, it's typical. Danny Fields calls it Ramon's luck.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, with every great thing that happens to the Ramones, some bullshit thing happens to fuck it up.
Yep, right. That's
always
true. Yeah, it's true.
Ramon.
Oh, man. So you've got all these music video credits, right? You did the documentary reels. What's life like now for you? What are you working on now? Anything new that you'd like to plug?
Well, yeah, sure. Two years ago, I did three music videos. The lead singer from the Fatima Mansions, also Micro Disney, which just got a documentary, and they were put into the Irish Music Hall Hall of Fame. I did two videos for my friend Cathal's first solo album in 10 years. And it was during the pandemic, basically. And I wanted him to have like a band video. It's the first, if you go on my website, it's the first one up, I believe.
Okay.
And it's a cool video, considering I had everyone shoot themselves. I kind of directed how I wanted the lighting. I had them all shoot themselves and where to put the camera. And what I did is I played it all back on like an iPod and a couple of telephones. And then I put them in different setups in places like you would never imagine those to be, so I could get the feel for a band. And it really worked out. But I'm doing documentaries. So I have an old jazz documentary about the Jones brothers, which is Hank Jones, Thad Jones, and Elvin Jones.
Okay.
Elvin Jones is a legendary drummer for the John Coltrane band.
Okay.
And he has, over decades since his death, he has become like the greatest legendary drum player, you know, drummer ever. And so I have that film coming, but I made that with government grants and with our current president and his sidekick. All the people that in the government that come up with money for arts programming have been pretty much told that they will not have a job by the end of the year and they should stop financing things.
Yeah.
But luckily, the movie is 95% complete.
Yeah, it's good.
So it could have a life in film festivals, and hopefully somebody will put it on television. And I have another documentary starring about Willie Tyler and Lester.
Okay.
Do you remember them at all?
I don't know. Who are they?
African-American ventriloquist with a sassy partner.
Okay.
They were on Laughing, on
yeah.
Every variety show.
Okay.
And they were on every talk show. They were one of the original Comedy Store comedians, which, if you know anything about comedy,
yeah,
that original Comedy Store was the breeding ground of the greatest comedians of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Seinfeld, Jay Leno.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the name? Who died? We got a desert in America. We just don't live in it. Bye.
Oh, Kinison?
Yeah, Kinison.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so he was part of those comedians. And
yeah.
He toured the world. He was the first black artist to open for a white artist. He opened for Anne Margaret the first time she played Vegas for a month. produced, underwritten by Mr. Elvis Presley. And it's a really great documentary. We have virtually every important person except for Dave Chappelle in the movie. You know, we have Chris Rock and Adam Sandler and Margaret Cho and all the ventriloquists. It's a really nice documentary. It's not heavy, though we do touch on, he was part of Motown. So we do touch on, touring in the Chitlin' Circuit and touring in the South where they had to sleep on the bus and occasionally somebody would light up a cross or shoot at the bus.
Yeah.
But they were young people and they just kind of rolled with it. It. They shot up the bus. Anything lasting? Any problem? Okay, let's move on to the next location. And so they would sing and forget about their troubles.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned your website. So how can listeners follow you if they want to learn more about you and and like these documentaries and your body of work and anything you may have coming up in the future?
Can go to georgeseminar.com.
Okay.
There's I put a thing up there for music videos. Transferring analog music videos to digital is difficult. And the pre-digital digital world of videotape, some of the formats that they swore up and down sideways were the format to master in. It turned out not to be the format to master in.
Sure.
So yeah, so it costs about $100 every time I want to bring out a music video. So I put a bunch of my favorites or videos that were important to me on the in the in the music video gallery.
Yeah. And I think the majority, if not all the stuff you do with the Ramones, I think it's up on their YouTube channel. And
Yeah,
if
the
you
YouTube channel.
yeah, if
Well,
you go there.
I didn't put it up. They put it up. Somebody put it up.
Yeah, it's out there. So yeah. And
And it has that one has some oddball items on it as well. Like videos I forgot about.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And if like I said, I'll link that site in the show notes. So if anybody wants to go visit, all they gotta
There
do is go
anything
in.
you specifically want to ask that I didn't touch on?
No, I think I asked everything. I think you hit on anything else that I had down. You naturally just kind of hit on it. So yeah, I think we covered everything. It's pretty wild to think of your involvement, and knowing Joey, growing up with around some of these guys, and then end up, working for them. That's kind of, I mean, that's kind of the punk rock way, and that's the Ramones way, right? So many of those guys just in their camp, just they grew up around and knew, and they end up working with them and giving them jobs. That's just what they did. And that's how they worked. And these guys, like Monty and Arturo, we worked for them for decades.
Decades.
Yeah, it's just they were it was a it was very tight. They're all very loyal to each other, and it worked for them. And it's so remarkable how iconic they are now. When they were they had to tour constantly just to keep doing their thing, but that's so punk rock, right? I mean, so many of these
So punk.
guys.
The only good thing, I mean, the one thing that they didn't have to do that most punk rock people did was figure out where the fuck they were going to sleep.
Yeah, well, that's true, right?
They got successful enough early enough on that touring wasn't a couch,
Yeah,
right?
correct.
Like you take, a great punk rock band like Murphy's Law. I
Yeah.
guarantee you, he's still trying to figure out where he's going to sleep when he gets to the gig.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, there's a thing, like all these huge bands that are iconic, quote unquote, bands from punk rock that people think of when they were doing their thing, they were just, man, they were just trying to make money to eat. And
Yeah,
and now they're considered legendary, but it's like, man, that wasn't there when they were active.
my house on Second Street was a big house, and I lived on the top floor, and I would rent out periodically the lower level, and I had my in-laws living in the middle. And it was not uncommon for me to put up a touring band.
Yeah.
So I had, let's see who I had stay there. I had the Sugar Cube stay there, and had a meal cooked by Bjork. I had Primal Scream stay there.
No, yeah.
I had, I'm thinking now, who else stayed there?
I always love Primal Scream.
Primal Scream got better and better as they became less of a shoegaze band. I mean, the fact that he was a drummer for from was it Jesus and Mary Chain, or
Something like it, yeah.
then he became the singer of Primal Scream. Then all of a sudden he became the lead guitar player and the singer from Primal Scream, and those songs are great straight up rock and roll.
Yeah.
But get your rocks off, baby, come on, you know,
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah.
what I mean, what a great song.
Yeah.
A guy I can't stand anymore, Bob, Kid Rock, stay
Oh,
there.
yeah.
I mean, I did three videos for Kid Rock, and he's a very charming guy, but this whole MAGA thing with him is just not, it kind
Yeah.
of, you know, we forget that, you know, that we're not all exactly what we are. And the fact of the matter is, you can't escape being a poor white guy in America if you were a poor white guy.
Right, yeah.
It was, you know, my mother was periodically on welfare. We got government cheese, you know, but my mother was a woman who believed in art. And she believed in people's inalienable rights.
Right, that's right.
She didn't get a chip on her shoulder.
Yeah. I mean, lots of people forget the roots and where they came from.
Yeah, and they also forget, you know, like affirmative action, right? Everyone,
Yeah.
oh, they're taking white spots from the school. And it's like, no, you idiot. You know, it's not like they're going into McDonald's and picking the guy who wipes out the toilet and giving him a scholarship to Harvard.
Yeah, right.
They're finding the black kid in your high school who is a straight A average, who's hoping to go to community college, but for some reason his advisor suggested he apply to Harvard. And because he meets the criteria for Harvard, and he's also a perfect person of color, to make it more balanced and to fit like America, 14% of every university should be black, because that's how much of the country is black. And you can't, like that idiot girl who sued University of Texas in Austin. She barely graduated high school. She was never going to get into that college anyway. But you know, some guy put up the money to sue them to break affirmative action.
That's right.
You know, if we're not, if someone doesn't encourage us to do it, we're not going to do it.
That's right. Yep.
People like me who don't give a fuck what you say, I just do what I want to do, and you know, let the chips fall where they do. You can like it or hate it. I don't really give a fuck what you think. You know, like in the music videos. Most of my music videos were for little money. You'll see a video on my reel for Scatterbrain, Don't Call Me Dude.
Yep, right.
Earlier this year, the guitar player from that band did a series on Facebook about that band because someone sent him one of my drawings for it. And I happen to have all the storyboards for it. And he teaches design now. He's got another band, but he teaches design, and that's his day job. And he called me, you know, I should be a goddamn American hero. And he printed, he put them all up there, and then he compared them with still frames from the movie, because I did the storyboards like 3 months before the music video, and they're the same. You know, the same kind of images that I did in the storyboard, the same kind of color. You know, is consistent in my design choices. And I did some crazy, I got that band to do some crazy ass shit. You know, you
Yeah.
watch it, we'll see. But I didn't care. This is what you're going to do. You want to work with me? You're going to wear pigtails, and I don't care. I'm going to put you in a bikini because you're skinny and you're going to have pigtails. That's what I told this guy. And it was fine. When I did the video for the band live,
Yeah.
I made them take off their shirts and climb a tree. I actually made them do it. It was the last couple of shots on the video because it was in my storyboard. It was images that I wanted to see. I brought them out to a beach. We shot at dusk in a beach. We built a fire. We did all this stuff. I gave them their look that they toured on. Even now, they're middle-aged guys. They tour without their shirts on with a little paunchy belly. But that's their thing now, And so many people were like, "Oh, can I have these costumes so we can tour with them?"
Yeah.
It's like I look at everything, I look at art as one thing, right? Painting, photography, filmmaking, sculpture, it's all one thing. It's an application of an idea. What's the best application of this idea? Is it a drawing? Is it a painting? Is it a sculpture? Is it a music video? What is it? And even though I'm open to doing a music video for as little money as somebody wants to pay me, almost, as long as it doesn't cost me money, I'll do it. That Scatterbrain video, I did it for half product and half cash. Just in those days, you can go around and sell stuff. But when I got to go through the warehouse, I got a lot of records that I really wanted. I got the full run of Black Flag for whatever reason. Not that I'm into any of them now, but at the time, I was into Black Flag, so I had them all. I got all Circle Jerks records. I wasn't gonna sell those.
Yeah, right.
I still have them, for God's sake. But you got to be true to the idea of creating something. And a lot of people want to control that aspect of your behavior. They think there's something wrong or weird with somebody who is a creative person.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that's basically, like the hallmark of my life. And that's why, people, whenever I fill out those forms, they want to know my religion. I say punk. And sometimes they go, "What is this punk religion?" I said, "The punk religion is, I don't give a shit what you say. If you tell me not to do it, I'll do it. And I'll do it better than you." And one last thing about my art. You'll see that mostly what's featured on my website are my photographs. And my photographs have a distinct style, while the music videos have no distinct style, right? Because the music is different every time, right? I always think of myself as like a great session player. I come in and play the music video. I don't do the guitar lead, I do the video. Right, but with photography, it's closer to my brain art-wise. So when I do a portrait of Robin Williams, the one you'll see on the website is the one that I'm showing you on purpose because it's the one that he shows us a little bit about what he was going through at that time. Look at it. Look at Michael J. Fox. You get a feeling what he's going through. Misty Copeland, the first prima ballerina of color at the New York Ballet. You can see her drive. You can see all these things about her. Like, how did she go? She never saw ballet until she was 13 years old. The average ballet dancer starts training at two. Okay. She didn't see one until 13.
Yeah, right.
And within 7 years, she's a prima ballerina at one of the biggest ballet troupes in the world, most important, the one at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
So I try to, in my photographs, I try to find that ephemeral, that little, that feeling. When my mother saw my photographs for the first time, they were on a wall of the gallery, and she said, "Honey, I don't like any of these pictures." And I said, "Why?" She says, "They're intrusive. I feel like I'm looking into their souls, and I don't like it." So I was like, "Oh, did you have some free wine? You're my mom, but I really don't value your opinion. You know, if it's something technical I did wrong, tell me about it. But if it's about how I captured these people, that's why I'm capturing these people." All right.
Well, all right, and like I said, people can go to your site, see those some of those pictures, right? See some of those
I
videos.
welcome them all. And if you need a music video, I'm your man. I want to go out with 400.
There you go, right?
I'm
Yeah,
up
I'm
to
sure.
390. I only need 10 more.
Yeah, I'm assuming on the site you got a you got contact information, right?
Yes, I do.
Yep, there you go. Everybody, you looking to work with him, do with George, can collaborate, reach out to him, talk to him, and you never know what might happen.
You
And
never know.
that's right.
So thank you so much for helping keep this band alive.
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for coming on, and telling your story. It's a Man, it's a great story, working with them, knowing Joey and those guys, when you were young. That's what it's all about, man. Telling these stories. Not just, oh, I saw him in concert or whatever, but the people that knew him, worked with him. And there's lots of guys, right, aren't out there, right, that didn't play the shows. People don't know about them, that did a lot of work with them and everything else, and helped, captivate, or capture some of that image and everything else. So I appreciate you giving me your time and coming on, telling your stories and talking to me. It's been a blast, and we maybe we'll have to revisit down the road and talk some more.
If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number two, and Screams.
Hey, Bruiser buddies, I want you to listen to Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty. Every week, he has the roughest and toughest interviews in the podcast world today, with the best guests you could ask for. There's no bums on this show. Let Dave Dynasty be your podcasting tag team partner and listen to Wrestling Nostalgia while drinking beer, smoking cigars, and busting heads. Just look it up on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today, because the Bruiser said so.
All right. And thank you to George for coming on and visiting the show and doing that interview. What a great chat. I would like to chat more with George in the future. But next episode, my guest will be John Holmstrom. Now, you should know that name because he is the founder of Punk Magazine and is the artist on the Rocket to Russia and Road to Ruin albums. Lots of great stories there. Great chat I had with John, and that episode will be available on May 1st. Thank you to all of you listeners and followers for sharing, for interacting with me on social media. Be sure to tell your friends and fellow Ramones fans about the podcast and help us continue to grow. Once again, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, leave us a rating and review, and follow us on social media. Again, we're on all the platforms. Just search for Pinhead Pod. Be sure to share our post, help the podcast audience grow. And you can also give us feedback, suggestions, tell us your Ramones stories, etc. on all those platforms. And also, be sure you go and give our friend Ricky Rochelle a follow on social media and your favorite music streaming platform. All right, and until next month and the next episode, when I have John Holmstrom on, be good, be safe, and gabba gabba hey. What the